So, if you've ever heard of the 400 silent years.
Right, the centuries right between the Old and New Testaments.
Yeah, exactly. People think history just went completely silent. But if you actually look at the dirt, the banned books, and the ancient fake news from that era, you'll hear the absolute loudest, bloodiest, and just most dramatic 4 centuries of human history.
It's a huge misconception that this era was just a blank slate. By digging into the historical record, which we're doing today, using the really extensive lecture notes of Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino, you quickly realize that the people living through these centuries were intensely loquacious.
Like incredibly talkative.
Very talkative. They left behind this massive trail of political drama, brutal wars, and literature that was basically designed to help them survive unspeakable trauma.
And the mission for our deep dive today is to figure out how we actually reconstruct ancient history from all that chaos. Because we are going to explore how historians piece together a coherent narrative for you using a completely chaotic mix of buried dirt, highly biased gossip columnists posing as historians, and, banned books.
Right. And my goal is to help you sift through those physical fragments and just the sheer human messiness of it all. We need to look past the biases to understand not just what happened during the supposedly silent era, but why these ancient people made the really extreme choices they did.
Okay, let's unpack this whole concept of silence first. The idea of the 400 silent years is actually a specifically Protestant theological interpretation.
Yes, it is.
It comes from the book of Amos. There's this prophecy about a coming time when there won't be a famine of bread or water,
Right.
but a famine of hearing the words of Yahweh. So based on that prophecy and the passing of the prophet Malachi, the Protestant tradition generally holds that divine authoritative prophecy simply ceased for 4 centuries. And because of that theological stance, certain books written during this period, what we now call the Apocrypha, were eventually removed from most Protestant Bibles.
And looking at this strictly as historical context provided by our source, it is crucial to note that this theological view is not universal at all. The Catholic and Orthodox traditions did not remove those books.
Right.
They retain them as part of their canon. So for vast majorities of the historical Christian world, those centuries were never textually blank. They always had a voice.
But then you have the problem with the just dig it up argument, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like this idea that we can bypass these textual debates and rely purely on physical archaeology for objective truth. But dirt has massive limits.
It really does. There is a live debate among scholars who want to push literary texts aside completely and just look at the physical evidence, but you cannot just bulldoze modern Jerusalem to see what is underneath it.
Because people live there right now.
Exactly. The city has been inhabited continuously from ancient times to today. People's living rooms, their businesses, their holy sites, they're sitting directly on top of the history we want to study.
So archaeologists are left with literal fragments.
Yeah, shattered pieces of pottery, foundations of broken walls, and from that, they have to painfully reconstruct the past using a heavy dose of creative interpretation.
It's like trying to reconstruct a family's really complex emotional dynamics
Yeah.
purely by digging through their trash.
That's a great analogy.
Right. Like you find broken plates, you're like, oh, they had a fight. You get pieces, but you need their diaries to actually know the drama.
And we see the extreme end of that physical limitation at places like Masada.
Oh, wow. Masada.
Yeah. Archaeology can pinpoint the exact location of a Roman siege ramp or the dimensions of a fortress wall, but it struggles to capture the psychological state of the people inside.
because it was a mass suicide, right?
Exactly, during the Jewish revolt against Rome. But archaeologists uncovered something there that bridges that gap. Amidst the tragedy of that site, they found a deliberately buried fragment of a scroll.
A scroll.
Yes, it was from the book of Ezekiel, specifically his vision of the resurrection of the dry bones.
Oh, man. Imagine the psychological weight of that moment. You're surrounded by an unstoppable Roman army. You know your rebellion has failed. You are doomed. And your final act is to carefully bury a text about dead bones coming back to life.
It's powerful.
That is not just a piece of trash left behind. That is a theological manifesto.
It really is. And it shows us why archaeology and text must work in tandem. That single fragment tells us that these doomed individuals were clinging to the profound hope that eventually their nation would rise again from the ashes. It's incredibly poignant.
Yeah.
But a single scroll fragment cannot explain the complex geopolitical maneuverings that led to the Roman army being there in the first place.
Right. To get the full story of the politics and the personalities, we have to look for the diaries of the ancient world, the historical texts.
Which brings us to the fatal flaw of those ancient diaries.
They were completely biased.
Exactly. The people writing them were essentially highly biased gossip columnists. Ancient historians did not operate with our modern standards of objective journalism.
No, not at all. Like the Greek historians, they hated the Persians.
Right.
So when Herodotus writes about the Persian Wars, he includes wild, sensational rumors just to make his enemies look bizarre.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He casually drops a story about an entire village of people who turned into wolves every full moon.
In a history book.
Right, into what is supposed to be a serious historical account. Thucydides is a slight exception, often called the father of history because he actually bothered to interview eyewitnesses.
Which our source notes that the author of the Gospel of Luke likely copied in style, right? Patterning his Greek writing after that rigorous method.
Yes, exactly. But then you have figures like Cicero, the Roman orator, who becomes a vital historical source for the most paradoxical reason.
Because he complained so much.
Yes. Cicero absolutely despised the Jews. Yet because he hated them so viscerally, he complained about them constantly in his political speeches and writings.
So his sheer animosity accidentally preserved history.
Exactly. A wealth of historical details about Jewish political influence in Rome that we otherwise would have lost completely.
Well, Cicero's accidental preservation is fascinating, but he does not hold a candle to the main event of this era.
No, he doesn't.
If we want to understand the monumental clash between Judea and Rome, we have to look at a man named Flavius Josephus.
Josephus is arguably our most vital historical source for the entire first century.
Born around 37 AD, Jewish aristocrat, highly educated, and eventually a rebel general in Galilee during the Great Revolt against Rome.
But his personal survival story literally defies belief, particularly the event known as the Jotapatha affair.
Okay, set the scene for us.
So Josephus was leading the resistance in Galilee when the Romans arrived with their legions. They besieged the city of Jotapatha for 47 days. When the Romans finally breached the walls and started slaughtering the inhabitants, Josephus managed to escape.
He hides in a cave, right?
Yes, hiding in a cave with 30 of his most elite soldiers. And they recognized that the battle was entirely lost.
Yeah.
The soldiers, driven by this deep sense of honor, decided they would rather die by their own hands than surrender and be enslaved or crucified by Rome. They formed a suicide pact.
Wait a minute. Let's look at the math and just the sheer audacity of this claim.
Okay.
Because Josephus writes that he tried to talk them out of it, arguing that suicide is a sin against God.
Right.
When his soldiers refused to listen, he suggests a different method. Instead of dying by their own hands, they should draw lots and kill each other in pairs, moving methodically down the line.
Yes, that's what he claims.
So they're in a dark cave, drawing lots, executing their own brothers in arms, and Josephus just miraculously draws the very last number. He just happens to be the last man standing alongside one other soldier. The convenience of that survival is staggering.
The statistical improbability is exactly why modern historians view his account with intense suspicion. But what really demands our attention is how Josephus pivots in that desperate moment.
Left is one of the final two.
Right. He suddenly realizes the pact is a terrible idea. He uses his immense persuasive skills to talk his final partner into surrendering to the Romans instead.
Wow.
They walk out of the cave and Josephus is taken directly to the Roman general, Vespasian. And here, facing imminent execution, Josephus plays the ultimate psychological card.
He looks at the Roman general who just destroyed his city and tells him he is a prophet.
He weaponizes his own religious texts for survival.
It's wild.
He uses an oracle, likely drawing heavily on the apocalyptic imagery in the Book of Daniel. There's a prophecy about a ruler coming from the east to achieve universal dominion.
And he applies it to the Roman general.
Yes. Josephus looks at Vespasian and tells him that the Jewish prophecies weren't actually about a Jewish Messiah. They were about Vespasian himself. He predicts that Vespasian is destined to become the emperor of Rome and rule the entire world.
Vespasian must have thought he was a raving lunatic just trying to save his own skin.
Probably. But Roman culture was deeply superstitious. Vespasian decides to hedge his bets. He puts Josephus in chains and promises to reward him if the prophecy comes true.
And against all odds, following a chaotic period of civil war in Rome, known as the Year of the Four Emperors, Vespasian actually seizes the throne.
The prophecy materializes. Vespasian remembers the captured rebel general in chains.
And Josephus is not only freed, he is elevated.
Highly elevated. The former resistance leader is given Roman citizenship, a generous government pension, and an apartment in the former estate of the emperor in Rome.
He survives the complete annihilation of his homeland by ingratiating himself with the very architects of that destruction.
Yes, he does.
But you cannot just move into the Roman emperor's guest house and expect the people you abandoned to forgive you. Josephus was viewed by his surviving countrymen as a massive, unforgivable traitor.
Oh, absolutely despised.
So to manage this catastrophic reputation, Josephus launches what we would today recognize as a massive, multi-volume public relations campaign.
He writes extensive histories to justify his life choices and reshape the narrative of the war. His first major work, The Jewish War, is just a masterclass in political spin.
Written strictly for Roman consumption.
Strictly. He has a really delicate needle to thread. He must explain why the Jewish people revolted without making his own aristocratic class look culpable.
So who does he blame?
His solution is to blame the entire catastrophic war on lower class hotheads and religious zealots.
Of course.
He frames himself and the other wealthy elites as reluctant, moderate participants who were dragged into the violence against their will. Concurrently, he depicts the Roman generals, Vespasian and his son Titus, as noble, almost superhuman figures who showed incredible restraint.
So he is basically writing survival propaganda.
Exactly. But eventually, he realizes he needs to defend his native culture to his new Roman colleagues who viewed his people with deep suspicion.
Right. So he writes the Antiquities. And to understand this book, you really have to understand a fundamental quirk of Roman cultural psychology.
Which is?
Romans revered antiquity and deeply distrusted innovation. To a Roman mindset, if a religious practice was ancient, it was respectable and favored by the gods. If it was new, it was dangerous, subversive, and a threat to civic order.
They respected the Egyptians because the pyramids were undeniably ancient.
Exactly. But they viewed the Jews as a strange, new, upstart culture.
And Josephus understood this Roman bias perfectly. To bridge that cultural gap, he blatantly exaggerated Jewish history to make it seem foundational to the rest of human civilization.
Like the Abraham story.
Yes. He writes that the biblical patriarch Abraham traveled to Egypt and personally taught the Egyptians how to build the pyramids and understand astrology.
He is turning Abraham into the ancient world's premier architect just to impress his Roman bosses.
He is completely rewriting the historical timeline to grant his culture the one thing Romans respected, ancient prestige.
But it wasn't just about prestige, right? It was about literal survival against vicious ancient fake news.
Yes, and that brings us to his work against Appian. It's a desperate defense against ancient blood libel.
Because you had an Egyptian writer named Manetho spreading a narrative that the Jews were not a noble ancient people.
Right. Manetho claimed they were rather a race of diseased lepers who had been forcibly expelled from Egypt.
And these rumors were not just idle gossip. They were potent political propaganda used to justify systemic oppression. I mean, there was graffiti discovered in Rome mocking Jews for supposedly worshiping a golden donkey's head hidden inside the Holy of Holies.
It gets worse. There were widespread, horrifying rumors that Jewish priests kept a Greek citizen tied up in the temple to brutally sacrifice him every year.
Just insane, hateful rumors.
And Josephus had to write these massive theological and historical defenses just to debunk them because they actively threatened the Jewish diaspora living throughout the Roman Empire.
And the ultimate irony of this massive literary endeavor is that Josephus, this upper-class, highly educated, aristocratic defender of his people, admits he could not actually write well in Greek.
No, he couldn't. He was fluent in Aramaic and Hebrew.
But to reach the Roman elite, he had to hire Greek assistants to translate and polish his PR spin.
The great historian of the ancient world essentially relied on ghostwriters for his grammar.
Amazing. But if Josephus represents the elite, compromised narrative coming out of the Roman palace, that leaves a massive gap in our historical understanding.
It does. What were the everyday persecuted people back in Judea actually reading and writing to cope with their trauma?
Right. Which brings us back to the text we mentioned earlier, the Apocrypha.
Exactly.
St. Jerome actually coined the term Apocrypha when he was translating the Bible into Latin in the late 4th century. The word simply means hidden or obscure.
And Jerome distrusted these texts because he didn't know their exact Hebrew origins, so he attempted to delete them from his Latin translation.
But these books were so deeply ingrained in the cultural consciousness that the very next generation of readers forced them right back into the text.
They forced them back in because these texts were not dry academic theology. They were vibrant, urgent tools for cultural survival. When you read the Apocrypha, you are reading narratives designed to help a marginalized group maintain their identity under the crushing weight of foreign assimilation.
Take the Book of Tobit, for example.
Oh, Tobit is fascinating. It features a young man teaming up with a disguised angel to fight a demon, cure his father's blindness, and rescue a woman from a curse.
So it's an adventurous narrative.
Yes, but one that reinforces the idea that God is intimately involved in the suffering of the righteous.
Then you have the Book of Judith, which is intensely political.
Judith is often analyzed as the anti-Esther.
Right. Instead of working quietly within the royal system to save her people like Queen Esther, Judith takes direct, brutal action.
She uses her beauty to infiltrate the camp of a hostile foreign general.
Seduces him, gets him drunk, chops off his head with his own sword, and presents it to her people to inspire a military victory.
Think about why a story like Judith was politically necessary. For a population living under harsh foreign occupation, incapable of defeating the empire in open warfare, Judith serves as an empowerment fantasy.
It tells the oppressed that wit, courage, and faith can topple imperial giants.
Similarly, the apocryphal additions to the Book of Daniel, like Susanna and Belle and the Dragon, function as the world's earliest detective stories.
Ancient detectives, I love that.
In these texts, Daniel uses deductive reasoning to expose corrupt religious officials and prove that foreign idols are just clay and brass. They are narratives designed to expose the fraudulence of the occupying culture's religion.
But these texts also document massive, real-time theological clashes happening within the Jewish community. The historical landscape was fracturing into different sects.
Most notably, the Sadducees and the Pharisees.
Right. The Sadducees were generally the wealthy, aristocratic, priestly class who believed in strictly following the written Torah and rejected oral traditions. Crucially, they did not believe in an afterlife.
The Pharisees, conversely, were populist teachers who embraced a broader interpretation of scripture, oral traditions, and the evolving concept of bodily resurrection.
And you can see this theological civil war play out perfectly when you compare 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees. Both books document the Jewish revolt against the oppressive Greek Seleucid Empire.
However, 1 Maccabees was likely written originally in Hebrew and aligns closely with a Sadducean worldview. It is a gritty, pragmatic political history.
So when soldiers die in battle, the focus is entirely on their earthly honor.
And the legacy of their physical dynasty. There is zero mention of a supernatural afterlife in 1 Maccabees.
But 2 Maccabees, written in Greek, is a completely different theological animal.
It is intensely Pharisaic and focuses heavily on the glorification of martyrdom. It features a horrifyingly brutal account of a mother forced to watch her 7 sons be systematically tortured to death by a Greek king for refusing to eat pork.
But the entire theological focus has shifted, right? The sons do not die for earthly honor.
No. They die with the explicit, defiant hope of a bodily resurrection. One son literally holds out his mutilated hands and taunts his torturers, declaring that God will give his limbs back to him in the next life, while the king will face eternal torment.
Wow. You are reading how sheer trauma and unrelenting persecution forced a society to evolve their theology.
Exactly. When justice is utterly absent in this life, theology adapts to demand justice in the next.
It's a profound psychological adaptation.
Yeah.
And we see them actively modifying older sacred texts to fit these new, desperate religious needs.
The Greek additions to the Book of Esther are the perfect example of this.
Oh, yeah. The original Hebrew Book of Esther in the Old Testament is famous for a glaring omission. It never once mentions God.
No.
There is no prayer, no mention of the temple in Jerusalem, and no overt religious practices. It's a story of court intrigue.
But for an ancient community facing existential threats, a secular survival story was apparently deeply unsatisfying.
So in the Greek Apocrypha version, they simply fixed it.
They did. They inserted long dramatic prayers for Esther and Mordecai, added prophetic dreams, and layered heavy religious meaning over the political maneuvering.
It functions exactly like an ancient director's cut.
Or theological fan fiction.
Yes. Fan fiction designed to patch a perceived spiritual plot hole. So the story fits better into their evolving religious worldview.
It highlights that for these ancient communities, texts were not static museum pieces. They were living, breathing tools for survival, identity formation, and theological adaptation in a hostile world.
So what we call history of this era is rarely a neat, objective timeline of dates and battles. For you listening, it is a messy, deeply human collage.
Very human.
We are piecing the truth together from shattered pottery buried under inhabited cities, lucky survivors who rigged suicide packs to become Roman propagandists, desperate public relations campaigns against ancient blood libel, and theological action stories written by a people trying to understand why they were suffering.
And that messy human element forces us to confront how we view authorship and authenticity itself. Our source material from Dr. Tomasino delves into pseudepigrapha.
Books written in the name of long-dead saints.
Right. These are texts like 1st Enoch or 4th Ezra, which claim to be the first-hand accounts of ancient biblical figures, but were actually written centuries later.
Often in the immediate, agonizing aftermath of the Romans destroying Jerusalem in 70 AD.
Exactly. Now, from a modern legalistic perspective, we would instantly classify that as forgery.
Or identity theft, or a blatant copyright violation.
Because we view it through a lens of intellectual property. But in the ancient world, after suffering a massive collective trauma, like the burning of their temple and the slaughter of their people, adopting the voice of an ancient prophet was not an act of deception.
It was a vital psychological survival mechanism.
Yes. It was a way for a traumatized author to channel an ancient, deeply trusted voice to bring a message of cosmic hope into their current unbearable nightmare. They needed Ezra to speak to them because their own voices felt completely powerless.
Wow.
Which leaves us with a critical thought for you to consider. Does our modern rigid obsession with intellectual property, copyright, and strict literalism actually limit how we as a culture are allowed to process and survive our own collective traumas today?
That is heavy. When you look closely at the dirt in the banned books, you realize the voices we need to understand history aren't always the objective observers. Sometimes the most truthful voices are the ones screaming for survival through the mask of an ancient prophet. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
Keep questioning the layers behind the histories you read.
And remember, even the supposedly silent years are deafening as long as you know how to listen.